This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. How did you get started in comedy?
It was 1997. And it was a New Year's resolution. It genuinely was not one of those sort of Dave Gorman-esque type things. Oh, mate, bet me £5. I couldn't tell a joke where I used the word Lilliput 18 times in a row. It wasn't anything like that. It was a New Year's resolution because I've always wanted to do it. I've always watched comedy on the television. Very rarely did I go to live stand-up. I knew it existed, and I thought I'd love to do that. That would be fabulous. I was sort of a precocious child who wanted to do acting. When I was pre-teen, and then I sort of immersed myself in the world of girlfriends, then immersed myself in the world of work, and then I was about 5 years later. I was 23, and I was thinking, right, I've got to have a go at this, and that was it. Really, it was a sort of a New Year's resolution to try it. I did 5 minutes in my local comedy club.
So, how old were you at the time?
23.
Okay,
and. I was addicted from the beginning. The first time I did it, it went very well. And the second time I did it, I went very well. And on the basis of my entire experience of stand-up, which was two gigs at that point, I thought, I've nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third time it went horribly.
Yes, that's it's just a case of waiting, isn't it?
Just the possible beat in the first. Using similar material in the same room to different people. And then I went home and I felt like I'd been beaten up. And then the following day I woke up and I was fascinated, because what was this bizarre black magic science that allowed you to have so many similar parameters and yet a completely different outcome?
Mm-hmm.
I was obsessed not just with the buzz of getting up on stage and performing, which is a wonderful sort of ego injection, but mm-hmm. also this black magic of how you make people laugh when they don't know you and there's no common ground and it's all artifice.
Sure.
And the fact that it can go brilliantly or terribly, and at that embryonic stage in my comedy career, which of course was not a career at that point, it was the beginnings of a hobby.
Yeah.
Why could it be so different? And I became obsessive about both wanting to perform and also the science of how this works.
The science of how it works, because that I think that's quite interesting, because I think you're a very technical comedian, by which I don't mean that there's no inspirational leaps or anything like that, but you are constantly, you seem to be thinking about it all the time, dissecting it. You're one of those people that loves taking a joke and going, oh, do you know what you could do? Or rather than, you know, some comedians are like, suggest a tag to one's joke when one comes off stage. You're someone that'll, like, the thing you were saying to me last night was, oh, you know, the way you're saying that now, it works really well on the page, but it's got to work really well out of the mouth. Why not take that particular exchange and turn it into a dialogue between you? You've got a very scientific approach to it, and that's always been like that, has it?
Yes, but as soon as I said the science of comedy to you, I automatically felt a little bit dirty.
Sure.
Because I don't think comedy is a science. I think it's an art first and foremost.
Sure.
But because I'm from an engineering background, my A-levels are maths, physics, computers.
Okay.
And, you know, we're not unique in the world of comedy. I mean, it's the vogue thing right now to be into comedy and science.
Sure.
It was literature. Before then, it was debunking religion. Science. because of my approach to understanding problems, I will, like you say, dissect information into smaller bits and then try to work out how that works. But don't get me wrong, I think comedy's an art form, and I have had arguments with other comics who believe it is more of a science, as in people who tell me there is a formula to a joke, and I will say absolute bollocks. That's not the case.
Sure.
A not that well known now, but better known comic about 8-9 years ago, and those people who know the industry are I'm not going to have problems working out who it is, decided to do a German character.
Yes.
Okay. And he decided, because of that, and he would debunk Germany, he would be extra Teutonic and extra literal and extra pedantic, and that would be the joke. And he said to me, and he's worked out, he said, that this approach and character was the funniest thing he could do. It was the way he could be sharpest and focus for the jokes, right? And then, at the same time as he was doing it, Henning Vane turned up, who is German, and on a couple of occasions would turn up on the same bill as him. So here we had actual German bloke doing comedy and British bloke pretending to be German bloke doing comedy.
Yeah.
And what happens was British bloke pretending to be German doing comedy would die horribly, right? Despite his formula and his science about how he should make this, this would be technically the funniest thing he could do, because a crowd full of people are looking at a person that, you know, and could ascertain and understand very quickly that if you're going to want to laugh at somebody, you've got to be able to empathise with them.
Yes.
Now, a lot of newer acts will mistake that for like them.
Okay? Yes.
And I'd say it is important to be liked by an audience for 97% of all acts.
Mm-hmm.
But Simon Evans, who I think is one of my favourite acts in the world
to watch,
when he was an open spot, right? I mean, I'm talking about, well, I mean, he wasn't an open spot very long because he's a very talented individual. But when he was still starting out in comedy, he would walk out on stage and go, well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. And if you're having problems placing the accent, it is indeed educated. And it was just this beautiful, dismissive, higher status, flippant sort of slap of the crowd.
Sure.
At the outset, when people didn't know him and he would get a laugh and they established his status, and it just debunked this theory that you've got to make a crowd like you. No, you haven't. You've just got to make a crowd empathise with you.
Okay.
You know, you the crowd have got to sit there going, that's funny because we get you. Whereas you still got to walk out and be able to empathise with 100 people to understand what must it be like to be looking at me.
Yes. Yes, that's it. Absolutely. They need to understand that you know what they feel looking at you.
Well, every established, if you want to know the difference between an experienced comic and a non-experienced comic, it's in the nature of their toppers. And by that I mean circuit comedians, because there are people at the top of the comedy tree who do things that are so unique to them that nobody else could do it. And that's actually kind of what a lot of us are all aiming for.
Sure.
All of us want a 20-minute set that nobody else could do as well as ourselves.
Absolutely.
You know, right. You know. So, but what I mean of the topper is like when someone says a joke, and then they say at the end of it, there's a lot of people in the room looking at their other halves thinking, I don't do that. Or there's a lot of people sort of thinking, as you can imagine, I'm a little bit scared when I first wrote that. I think Ben Elton first started doing it.
Yeah, okay.
I think he used to do material about putting down a single sheet of toilet roll at a guest bathroom so that they did a poo, it didn't make a splash.
Sure.
And then he'd make a joke going, first I told that joke, ladies and gentlemen, I was genuinely worried I was the only person who did that.
Yeah, I think I remember that. Yeah.
Well, there you go. That is probably the history of the comedy topper.
Yes.
This idea. And what is that? That is evidence of empathy with a crowd, right?
Yes.
And that is evidence of experience, because you have spent enough time thinking about what it must be like to listen to you as you have about what jokes am I telling and how do they come across.
Yes. We were talking the other day about your persona. We were talking about personas on stage, and you were. I'm coming at this from the point of view of the way you've described it, and I know we don't want to use the word scientific because that sounds.
No, like we can use scientific, but it's not.
It risks sounding cuntless, and that's not what we mean.
No,
yeah. But we were talking about the way that some people have a persona which is ready formed, which seems like something people in the audience can go, ah, this is this person.
Mm.
Now, I don't know that I don't feel that I have that particularly. People might look at my act and go, okay, he's cheeky, he's charming, he's a bit naughty, you know, it seems quite, it's not that defined at the moment. And we were talking about the similarities there, in that you aren't coming on and being the guy who, you know, audiences wouldn't necessarily know how the character, the persona of Stephen Grant is going to react to a particular obstacle in his path. And you were talking about a conversation you'd had, which I, if you wouldn't mind
explaining
again, I thought that was fascinating, about the lab coat.
Yeah, well, this is it. It's going back to what we said about being sort of not enormously recognisable as to an audience by virtue of having no unique identifying characteristic.
Sure, an audience that you are nonetheless making howl with laughter.
Yeah, absolutely. And going, well, what do I need to do in order to stand out in people's minds? How do I make people walk away from there remembering my name and what I look like? Those unique identifying characteristics that take you above that level, what do I need to become? And it's a question you can ask yourself glibly without realising the genuine significance of that question. Because I, you know, was having a bit of a a sort of a frustrating period when things were going well for me, but I just couldn't get onto, you know, the right sort of TV and priority stuff. And I was, you know, some of the bigger gigs were still sort of not really using me, and I just thought, well, this is affecting my ability. I'm a bit of a vicious circle here. I'm not getting the profile to get the shows, and I'm not getting the shows to get the profile. And I felt that something had to be actioned by me to take it above that level. And I talked to John Lloyd, the exec producer on QI, because I worked for QI for many, many years. Mm. First in the warm-up, and ended up doing sort of writing and helping out with pilots and stuff and everything like that. And it's a great company because they make you feel like a family, and you feel like you're part of the family. And I sort of took him to one side and said, look, John, this is a terrible thing to sort of bend your comic ear, but he's just, this bloke's got a wealth of understanding and knowledge of comedy. What would you do if you were me, if you were to try and sort of make yourself stand out? And he had a bit of a think, and you could tell he was sort of looking sort of over dramatically at the ceiling, and then he went, I would wear a lab coat if I were you and have some pens in your pocket, and then go really, really pedantic, really technical, sort of quite annoyingly so, you know, push the joke, you know, because I don't think anyone else is doing that. It would really stand out. And I thought, well, first of all, these are the words of a comedy genius, and they can't be dismissed. So I went off and I thought about it. And I thought about what I would do, and, you know, that's the whole idea of being a kind of a stupidly anal, geeky sort of, you know, persona, which is an extension on some of how I am on stage.
Yeah, and it also, just you saying it now in a way that hadn't resonated with me before, we just talked about your scientific background, your obsessive, you know, the way you take apart ideas and analysis and stuff. It really would seem to be you rather than just a coat you were putting on.
Totally, absolutely. And you know, it may well be a character. It may well be, at the very least, an exaggeration of existing characteristics. Mm. But it's something that I could play. It's an extension of myself. You know, I'm sure there's a little bit of the pub landlord in Al Murray before he ever did it. Sure, likewise, sure. I'm sure there was a little bit of Lee Nelson and Simon Brogdon.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, even though the two characters, the character and the reality are the opposite ends of the class and education spectrum. But the thing is, I'm thinking, yeah, that's what you've done is he's tapped into something about me that may be more unique, and you could flower it. But why didn't I ever go down that route? Well, I'll tell you why, because I projected forward the path I would have to take, the path I then understood, because I've been working in comedy long enough to get to where it would need to be. And just didn't like the idea of doing it. I like the idea of being myself when I walk out on stage. I like the idea of not pretending to be something else. I'm not against acting. I quite enjoyed it when I was younger. But it's not... There's too much comfort zone in comedy. But there is something inherently lovely about people coming up to you afterwards and saying, I love what you did, when you know that what you did was largely you.
Yes.
Because they're saying, I love you.
Yes.
Which is much better than I love what you did.
Yeah.
Right.
That's remarkable. Yes, I totally know what you mean.
Not so much that it's needy, but more that it's life affirming. You know, you did a great thing is nice, but nowhere as good as you are a great person. Right. And I'm not sure I could drive a divide between act and me so far into my career, so that when people come up and say, I love what you did, and I've just done something that is an artifice, I can then go off and think they love me, because I wouldn't.
Is that, do you think, I think that's a really good point, is that, do you think, connected to you, like, what the thing that John Lloyd was describing was that you wear a lab coat. Now, that's a bit more of a character act than someone like Mickey Flanagan, who, you know, is the intellectual Cockney, say, but doesn't dress in a particular... Do you mean? Like, a lab coat is sort of like a job signifier. It's a bit more of an Al Murray sort of thing.
I mean, I don't think he was talking about a lab coat as in you're a scientist. I think he's talking about a lab coat as he's saying, as in you're a self-unaware geek.
Sure.
Right. Now, what's the parallel between a self-unaware geek and a intellectual Cockney? There are loads of them out there, and nothing really represents them in the way of voice and stature.
And there is currently no one doing that. That's the other...
Correct.
Yeah, if you're looking for a space at the table, here's one.
Yeah, and that was a comedy genius. That was somebody who doesn't just know comedy, but he knows industry. Yes. He knows the level playing field. There is a man who sits there looking at everyone and works out who do we get on the panel QI. Bear in mind it is the top panel show in the world. Mm. Right, okay, probably in the world actually, because it's sold everywhere. Mm. Right. The ones where the people I know who regularly do panel shows elsewhere are battering on his door going, get me on it. Mm. You know, it's that high up. And it's because he understands the landscape. He has to, because he needs to know who's sitting in what pigeonhole. And he thought, well, that would be a good one for me. And part of me sits there and thinks, maybe I've gone through my life regretting the fact they're not doing it. Maybe there's someone listening to this podcast right now going, well, if you're not going to do it, Grant, I'll do it.
Yeah, so there we are.
You know, but I remember, you know, being... Because my background is working in computers. You know, I worked in computers for many, many years. I was an engineer, I was a problem solver. And that was the way I thought. It's the way I solve problems. It's the way I approach any issue. Mm. Is with an engineering, scientific... You know, how do you eat an elephant? By cutting it into tiny pieces. You know, that sort of thing. You know, it's all how you break down a problem. Mm. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, I read a report in 1993 when I'd been working in, I hadn't started doing comedy yet, but I've been working in computers for 2 years, and saying that more people worked in the IT industry in Britain than in the car industry, which, bear in mind, that's okay, it's 20 years ago and people might not remember that, but that was astonishing news at the time. Mm. You know, Britain had this huge car industry and people didn't realize computers were something that, you know, like was in one room of every company, not in every room. Mm. I'm thinking to myself, you know what, in the future we'll be a nation of sort of IT specialists, you know, and there are a handful of people who know how to put a car together, you know. We're going to have, you know, double finger percentages of geeks in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the TV for the geeks? What's the music for the geeks? What's the clothes for the geeks? Mm. You know, this whole idea of geek chic, you are wildly unattractive to a woman if you're a geek. And I was a geek at the time. They've got this thing now where women actively seek out pasty faced, nerdy, thick glassed blokes, you know, blokes with a shirt button done right up to their neck. Yeah. And they get frothy over it. And I'm like, well, where were you? I was in my late teens and early 20s when I was trailblazing this look and feel, you know. Big Bang Theory, isn't it? The sitcom came along. This is huge. It's like one of the top 10 sitcoms in the world, and the rest of it, right? Because it appeals to, you've got all these geeks, you sit there and watch it, you know. They throw in an Indian bloke because there are sort of like, you know, it's the world's biggest percentage of geeks out there. And you sit there and you think, oh God, you know, we've missed a trick here. And in stand up, it doesn't exist yet. So yeah, I mean, it's a huge hole. Mm. You know, could do it. Might do it. Might have this conversation with you, put it down and think, sod it, I've got a baby now.
Ring me up.
I need to stop people telling me that they love me, and I need to start thinking about my future. So, you know, possibly. But typically, it will be just ideas. So I might grab my phone right now. Here we go. And what have we got here? We've got... In my notes. So this is great. I've got a notes application that buffers it, right? So we've got Twitter jokes.
It syncs online.
Twitter jokes.
Yeah.
So ideas for Twitter jokes I haven't done. Set lists.
Yep.
So there we go. So we're in the Middle East right now. So there's the base set of what I'm doing while I'm here.
Gotcha. Okay.
All right. So a line to describe each routine. A routine could be anything between a minute and 3 minutes long. And then meetings, feedback to other acts when I'm watching acts, because I forget it sometimes. I think of an idea to do with their joke.
Amazing.
So like for amazing example, you know, like, so I was watching Nathan Caton at the Comedy Store last weekend. He got a line, so I gave him an extra line at the top, but I know I'd forget by the end of it, so I'm watching other acts. There you go. There's some stuff at Christian O'Connell, the Raymond and Mr. Timken review. They're just an extra line they could have used. Some stuff for Doc Brown there, stuff for Paul Ricketts, you know, just basically I watch an act. That's the thing. I think interfering with other people's acts is probably how I got into writing. But most importantly, and this one, and I mean it's this one because look at that. Here we go. I'm scrolling down. I'm only halfway through.
This is the jokes one.
This is the jokes ideas. Right.
So those are all ideas for jokes rather than finished jokes. That's your day-to-day. Something occurs to you, make a note of it.
Have a go at reading one out, and then I will tell you what the joke... Because bear in mind, I've got to think of it right then, at that point in time. The more obscure, the better.
Okay. I get a tattoo of an exercise book on my cock.
Yes, it's because, you know, loads of people draw cocks on an exercise book. I just thought it's time that exercise books got their own back.
Nice.
Right, okay.
Nice. Do you do it with babies in the room?
Oh yeah, that's just an idea. The whole idea that if you've got a baby in the room, can you have sex with them in the room? Because to be fair, they should be all right with it. Because if it wasn't for that, they wouldn't be around.
Yes, gotcha.
Okay, so that's like an idea that hasn't got the jokes yet. I think there's one about three down. I thought you were going to pick because it was just a mixture of words.
There's a couple of them. This is fascinating. Facebook friends all the same age. In 50 years, they'll all start dying. This winter's a bitch.
Yeah.
Very good point. We're the Facebook generation, and that's going to move on, isn't it?
What's going to happen is like some people have got a range of ages, but the majority of Facebook friends, because if you're at school, are the same age as you.
Yeah.
So in 50 years' time, you know, 50% of your friends on your Facebook page, I'm assuming Facebook's around with then, mm-hmm. will all be the same age. And then they'll stop dropping like flies. Mm-hmm. They'll be like, oh my God. You know how people look at their friend count thinking people don't like them anymore?
Yeah.
Imagine what's going to look in your friend count in 50 years' time. So look, there you go. Well, yeah, we're laughing.
Sure,
there you go.
Sure.
So these are the ideas. I thought you might pick
those
this one.
Those are quite fully formed joke ideas, yeah.
You see, that's the thing that this isn't. Overstimulated, full stop. Burger porn sucked off equals wah.
Okay.
Right, that's one I thought you'd pick up because I remember looking at that recently and thinking, what the hell was I writing?
Sure.
And I realised it's another baby one. Unfortunately, when you have a baby, your brain does fill up with that
as well.
Of course, yeah. And what it was is that a lot of times when the baby cries, you know, it's going to be one of two major things. He's either tired or he's hungry. Okay. And to be fair, into adult life, we're like that as well. That's when we're grumpy, isn't it? Mm-hmm. When we're tired or we're hungry, right? You start crying. But the other one is that it seems to be unique for babies, which is they're overstimulated, mm-hmm. right? And he goes, no, I'm sorry, he's crying, he's overstimulated. And I was thinking, thank God that one doesn't go into our adult life as well. So there I was watching the football while eating a burger and this girl started sucking me off. Well, I just couldn't stop crying.
Yeah.
So that's the idea. The idea is that when did we stop having overstimulated as a problem?
So it seems to me that your process now, 16 years in, is really up and running. You're having ideas, you're automatically slotting them into a good joke order, and you're making a note of almost a fully formed joke, something you could certainly just read it off there, say it on stage at a new material night or whilst comparing or squeeze it to a set.
Well, comparing with me, and that's the thing, isn't it? It's crowbar.
Sure.
New material nights, I would use them so much more if I was more of a set act. But it just.
But with the opportunity to compare, there's no.
Well, you say the opportunity, but you know, 16 years on, that's where I'm more likely to be booked. Mm-hmm. But my kind of rule is, with the exception of the biggest clubs, which is the Store, the Glee, and the Comedia. Mm-hmm. You know, most other places they book me, I say no, I don't want to compare, I want to do a set, mm-hmm. because otherwise I don't really feel like I'm being stretched. It sounds pompous, I know, but there's very little left for me to learn as a compere, to be honest.
But what I'm getting at is, has your system always been this efficient? When you started off writing jokes,
Bits of paper that I would lose and then would find a week later and go, oh, that joke idea. No. If you were to ask me, people go, that's quite efficient. I think it's wildly inefficient. Mm-hmm. If I had a week free, I would take all of these jokes, develop the ones that need more developing because they're good already, start retiring ones that I'm only using right now because they fill a gap, there's probably a better joke out there, mm-hmm. and then start categorising them. And by categorising them, I mean under different categories. I will actually make a database of my jokes, okay? Mm-hmm. And this is people are sitting there right now thinking, oh my God, are you for real? But let me tell you how useful this would be. Length of the joke.
Yeah.
How coarse it is, I'll give it a rating. And then subject matters, right? So under certain subject matters, whether these jokes are on the basis of interaction feedback. So what job do you do? Where are you from? You know, country, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. You know, so they're all things that some jokes lend themselves to be part of banter and interaction. And then most importantly, suitability for warm-up, mm-hmm. suitability for corporate work, mm-hmm. okay? And then suitability for what I call sort of TV broadcast ability, because there's been times before when people say, hey, we're going to record this material, blah blah blah, can you make sure we don't do anything rude? And you're sure that bit's not rude, and as you're talking it, you're like five or six words ahead in your word, and you're, oh my God, I forgot there's this rude bit in the middle of the joke. That for me is wildly unprofessional, and it's happened to me a few times. Shouldn't do that anymore. So I want to categorise and database all my jokes.
Do you know someone who's done that? Is Delisa Chaponda. I've seen his folder before the gig, and they're in exactly the same categories, duration to the second of the joke, whether it's blue or not, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well,
incredible.
I know other comics would turn their nose up at that, but all I say to you is fair play to you, Delisa. Well done.
Mm-hmm. So we're here in Qatar at the moment, where you're a phenomenally well-travelled comic, and I noticed one of the strategies of the gigs we're doing at the moment is that you've got something to say about every country.
I've probably got something to say about everything. It's just smart-ass DNA, to be honest with you. But I find I find different cultures are such a rich source for comedy, and the light ribbing when you compare between them, it's almost infinite how much stand up there, isn't it? So no, I love it. I love comparing, you know, other cultures to British culture and vice versa. Be it positively or negative, makes no difference so long as it's funny. And yeah, I've spent a large portion of sort of 2009, I'd say, to maybe about 2008, 2007, all the way up to about 2011, just travelling flat out. I mean, it's I'm actually not a huge fan of travel. Mm. I just love doing comedy in other countries. Mm. On the whole, people are more enthusiastic. They're grateful because you feel it's a bit of an event when you turn up.
Absolutely.
When you do a comedy club in London, don't get me wrong, it can be perfectly good, but you look at them and you sort of think, you had nothing better to do.
Mm-hmm.
At best. Right. At worst, whereas, it's raining.
Whereas people here, I mean, specifically here in Doha, people are like, oh my God, English-speaking comedy, amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And so maybe the needy part of me is bowled away by how grateful they are.
Mm.
But you know, it's not just that, it's also, it helps my comedy. Travel broadens the mind, and a broad mind is very useful in comedy. I've come back with a lot of routines that I've written, sometimes not even anything to do with where I was and where I'm going. You know, I'm not a huge fan of comics who come on stage and say, so I was in this country and I noticed that ... and then there's like about 2 minutes of explanation because they have to do the setup to explain when you're in that country what something means.
Sure.
And then a joke, and you're sort of thinking, what you've done there is you've taken an aside back from a country that you exactly were talking about, and you're now telling it to a room full of people who not only don't know but don't care.
Yes, I've been wondering with my thing about the woman and the baby and the no public affection thing, I've already been thinking to myself, will that travel? Will that transfer back to the UK, or will it end up being too much setup and eventually you have to make
exactly... If we're going scientific on this, it is about the setup. If you can't fit that setup into a tweet, it's too much.
Yeah.
Simple as that. You know, but I mean, the answer to that one is, I think it probably just about would, but I'm not going to do your joke, but,
sure.
But the upshot of it is, I think it probably just about would. And there's probably a rich vein of comedy to be explored in the whole concept of public displays of affection. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, are we talking about holding hands?
Yes, right,
which
gotcha.
You do with a child. Or are we talking about being fingered around the back of a skip? Which, by the way, I'm going to say, actually, there are more jokes about finger around the back of the skip in Britain than there are skips. If all those jokes were accurate, there would be a queue behind most skips.
People if you were, if the listener would like to visit comedianscomedian.com/newhack, they will discover a list in which both skips and fingering feature highly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
All
yeah,
right.
You'll enjoy it. Have a look at it after
all
this.
Right.
I think it'll make
okay.
you giggle. Yeah. Let's talk about your place in the comedy community. Because as well as being an act, you're also someone that books a very successful, very much loved clubs in Brighton and Bath.
Yeah.
And how far into your comedy career were you when you started booking them?
Well, contrary to the majority of comics' perspective, who think I'm a megalomaniac or a control freak, I started running the club in Brighton because it was becoming too expensive and too difficult while I still had a day job to travel to London to do open spots.
Mm-hmm.
I had a job, my engineering job was out in the country, so I had to drive. So I would go home until about 6:37, and then I would be really pushed to get into London to do an open spot somewhere. And then I'd get home at like midnight or 1 a.m, you know, all of my food was on the move. Shower, you know, bed, 5 hours sleep, get up, drive to work. And it was just too difficult. And what I needed was a gig in Brighton.
Hmm.
So I ran 3 or 4 different gigs in Brighton, one after the other, that never really worked. And then Comedia, which was always a bit of an art house theatre in Brighton, nothing more than that, moved into a bigger venue in the North Lane, which is a very sort of very cool area of Brighton. And I thought, well, this could be an opportunity. So I went in there and said, look, I'd like to run a comedy club if possible. And he said, well, we can only give you a Sunday every... Well, at first they said, well, we don't really want to. And I said, why? He goes, we don't want anything. It's a bit end of the pier. It's a bit naff.
Mm.
And I said, well, it is. And I promise you, we'll book it to make it very, you know, very sort of admirable, artistically.
Mm.
So Cranberry run by sort of theatre people. So we'll give you a Sunday once a fortnight. And I'm like, okay, fair enough. And so we did the first one. I think Dominic Holland was my first closer. You know, I think I gave him my entire budget.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't... And we got 40 people in. I thought, it's going to be difficult. But then the second one got 80 people in. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is better. The third one got 120 people in.
Mm-hmm.
The third one, fourth one got 160, so I think I'm a bit of a curve. And the fifth one got 200, which was then capacity. And by then we were kind of towards the end of the summer, and I was thinking, well, this is going to work. This is good, mm-hmm. you know. And I was booking people that I was seeing doing open spots in London and the big headline acts, and then phoning them up. And I was basically paying for it out of my own pocket, making no money out of it. But it was great because I had a gig on my doorstep, because I wasn't really making money out of comedy then anyway. Mm. But it just snowballed. It just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it went from, you know, after 6 months of doing Sundays fortnightly, it went to weekly. Then it went to weekly Saturday and Sunday. Then it went to weekly Saturday early, Saturday late and Sunday. Then it went to weekly Friday, Saturday early, Saturday late and Sunday. Then it went to weekly Thursday, Friday, Saturday early, Saturday late, Sunday. Then it went to an extra show on the Saturday, yeah. overlapping show. So at one point we were doing six shows a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that period, Comedia got rebuilt three times,
mm-hmm.
right? Which was probably why they got into financial trouble, because the costs spiraled with that work. Because everyone couldn't understand why they got into financial trouble a few years ago. And it was nothing to do with the operations or the running and how popular it was. Because people were saying, well, if you're selling out, why are you in trouble? So they rebuilt it three times. You know, so we went from a 200 capacity to 240 to 270 to 292, which is where mm-hmm. we are now.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, I ended up with a second job through the back door. What originally was just an opportunity for me to do some more stage time. And it was just, it was a lot of work to book at the same time. And then I got someone who sort of like chipped in and helped. A few people had chipped in to help. And now I've got, you know, as of recently, got a full-time employee part-time employee who helps book the acts and everything. That's made a huge difference.
So how do you find that has changed the way you're perceived throughout the industry?
Well, positively in some ways, but actually negatively in some ways that most people don't realise.
Okay.
Right, the positive ways is that, and it's a bit fickle, but everyone's nice to me. Unless they don't play the gig, in which case they lose their patience. And it gives you a little bit of sort of kudos, because it is a successful club. If you run, a lot of comics have a
gig. I mean, it's a really nice club to play as well, isn't it? There's always punters in. Mm. It's always a good night.
And it's always a good bill.
Yeah.
You know, it's very rarely do you turn up and you think, oh, God, this isn't going to be fun. which you do a lot in comedy. But, no, it's really successful. I take as much pride in how successful that is as I do in my own successes, because it's my baby and it's taken, you know, years. And I didn't earn money on it for absolutely ages, you know, because I was just conscious of just making it as good as I could. And it wasn't ever about, I want extra dates, I want all the rest of it. Comedia always came back and said, we want to give you an extra date. So I just wanted to make a really brilliant comedy club, you know, because I realised it was good for my comedy as well to be surrounded by good acts. I'd say, you know, there are positives there. But there are negatives. There are negatives because you turn up at a gig elsewhere and comics barrack you for work.
Mm.
And I'm backstage trying to think about what I'm going to say when I go
mm-hmm.
on, and I can't. I've got no, and I've got to go and hide somewhere else.
Sure,
because people are going, well, I haven't done it for a year and a half. And I think, one of the problems of having a really successful club is we're massively oversubscribed. For every slot there are three people who are on merit who could do it.
Yeah,
Who don't get the gig.
Yeah, what we need to do now is use the. Lots of comics listen to the show, and what we should do is just say from now on, if you see Stephen at a gig you've not seen him for a while and he's preparing before he goes on stage, just give him a signal, just tug your earlobe, and he'll note that, meaning, "I'd like to play your club, please," and then you could just do that, and then they won't bother you.
Well, possibly. I think it's more likely, to be honest, that that I will see that and then remember that. And then think, oh, God, they're bothering me for a gig, and feel just as discombobulated.
There's no way out. No escape.
I don't think it'll work. So that's the negative. And the other ones as well, that people, when they stop playing the club or they haven't played it for a while, get quite aggressive with you. And then it makes it really awkward when you turn up backstage because you've got issues. Most people have fallen out with you because they want to play the club.
Mm.
But it's not just me involved. Comedia will watch people and say, we don't want that person back.
Mm-hmm.
But they pay me to not be the person who's gives that news out.
Yeah.
To give that news out. Thankfully, I got someone working with me. And then the other problem, and that is where I'm not going to name names, but there are a very small handful of extremely established clubs
mm-hmm.
who are of the opinion that if you book a club, you do so because you can't get work yourself on merit.
Okay.
And they look at club people who book their own clubs and go, well, you know what? That's why you're working regularly, because you've got your own club.
Yes.
And if you think about booker performers elsewhere in the industry. 10 years ago, it was a roster of some quite impressive people, because there wasn't, maybe 10, maybe 12, 15 years ago, when there was very few clubs outside London. You'd have Roger Monkhouse running his gig in Sheffield before he gave it to Toby Foster. You know,
did he start that? Did he start The Last Laugh?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't in that venue, obviously, elsewhere. Okay. But yeah, and I think it was even called The Last Laugh. But it was. But Roger had his gig in Sheffield. And
okay.
He was the resident comic there. It was a fabulous comic, as we know. And he did that because it was on his doorstep, you know. Dan Atkinson, who's now not really doing stand up anymore because he's comedy producing and directing, you know. He, you know, had a residency in York.
In York, yeah, I remember.
Yeah. Great comic, Dan. It's absolutely fabulous. Mm. So it was just the logistics of not being in London for a lot of people. And some of the London resident comics were very good, but outside London, you'd find better ones. You really would. Dan Nightingale and Jason Cook, both Hyena residents, you know, and moved on there sharply and with reason. And that's fine, but what happened was, is after the big clubs, you know, got a foothold in the out-of-town places, and Jeff Whiting came along and mopped up all those gigs that wouldn't financially be viable, because Jeff is very shrewd and works on a very tight margins, you know, to put comedy on in places where other people will go, the budget isn't there for it.
Sure.
They sort of disappeared, because you could be a comic in Leicester.
Yes.
And constantly work without having to find your own gig.
Yes.
So the people who had their own gigs and were gigging, there was this unfair perception that they had that because they couldn't find work on merit.
Right.
And I'm assuming there was, I can still think of a few people that for which that argument is accurate.
Sure.
But there was a long-held opinion that I was only running that club in Brighton because I can't get work on merit.
Frustrating.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the case of some very, very well-known clubs, it took 10 years to get in.
Sure.
10 years and an equal number of open spots to, you know, doing very well and going, well, the barrier to me getting in has got to be outside of my ability because I'm getting this right. I'm getting this right, even not from a pompous, egotistical perspective, but from one where other comics are scratching their heads going, I don't understand why you're not here.
Yeah.
You know, I was still not playing standard comedy clubs in this country despite having awards for comparing.
Yes.
Not award, awards. Mm-hmm. You know, and just sort of going, well, okay, right, but I know I can be awkward and difficult sometimes, but am I annoying to the level where people... Yes, probably am. Just ask myself that question. I just start thinking, that's, Stephen, you really don't want to know the honest answer to that. That's awful.
We'll get emails.
So actually, some disadvantages. So the advantage of actually having someone who deals with the bookings now on my behalf, apart from the time it releases so I can spend time with my new family, is also a huge advantage because... The distance between me and my gigs has been healthy. It's actually only been better. I thought it'd be worse. It's been better. And thankfully, a lot of people who don't have to be nice to me in order to get work are still nice to me, so they did actually like me all along. So that's a massive relief.